Well, thank you very much. You ready? Oh, this thing is, what is it doing to me here? So, what I'm going to do is tell you what to do after you've written your paper. Now, everybody wants to sound impressive, very profound, solid. And if you got the time, fancy, weird. But everybody wants to be A-plus worthy, you know. But the key word here is sound. Don't. That's my advice to you. Stop and say to yourself, now maybe we have too many gadgets in the field. Yes, we do. All right, well, let's remove one. See if that helps. All right. You see, I have this thing about computers. I think they are terribly unreliable. And I always bring extra equipment with me. So in this case, what I'm going to do is restart it. Yeah, slideshow. And let's see if that works better. Okay. Don't. All right. You want to avoid being cloudy. How do you do that? Well, what I'm going to talk to you about today is the essential quality you want your papers to have. Do I make myself clear? You don't have to sound like one of the great prose stylists of English literature. All you have to do is get your ideas across. That's all we want. And that's really all about the criteria of formal writing, what we call formal writing. That is to say, formal writing is something that you have to develop. It is different from writing a personal letter. It is very different from talking, as I am now. I'm quasi-formal, but I also be a little bit informal. When you're writing, you don't have access to a number of important tools. Grimaces. Oh, I know we have, you know, emoticons and things like that, but you don't use that for formal writing. Gestures, tone of voice. Don't do this. Don't do this, these kinds of things. You don't have that when you're writing prose. Those are very, very useful nuances that you have to express in letters on screens or on paper. And here's the problem. You finished your paper. Now what you need to do is back off, way off. You have to transform yourself from the author who knows exactly what he or she means to say and turn yourself into the reader who is not a mind reader, but just a page reader. And so you have to distance yourself from what you have just written. And if you're lucky and you wrote it early, you can take a day off and come back to it and look at it again. Ask yourself, what is it trying to tell me? Notice all these symbols and things up here. Remember, all you've got to work with is symbols on a page. What you want to look for is things that aren't quite clear. But in order to do that, I think you're going to have to do some things that you may not be doing. You have to turn yourself into an objective reader. And that's not easy to do. You have to train yourself for this. You have to imagine that you're one of your friends. Or you have to imagine that you're somebody you don't even know and who's reading your essay and saying, what did you mean here? I don't get that. Or did you mean this? Or did you mean this? What's the reference to this pronoun? So what I'm going to do very briefly is just give you a number of things that I find over and over again in student papers and, breathe a sigh of relief, in printed, published work. These are things I find all the time to my great dismay in published articles, even scholarly ones. None of us is perfect. All right, first of all, avoid colloquialisms, avoid slang, unless you're writing an essay on colloquialisms and slang, of course, and then you need examples. This is from a blog, verbivore.com. I just happened to run across, and it was published earlier this year. He has all kinds of puns in this. I'm just quoting from one section of it. It says, for a child, each new word is like a shiny toy, a toy that has no age. There are words that once did not exist, and there were words that once strutted their hour upon the earthly stage, alluding to Macbeth, of course, and now are heard no more, except in our collective memory. But just as one never steps into the same river twice, another allusion to Heraclitus, ancient Greek philosopher, one cannot step into the same language twice. Even as one enters, words are swept downstream into the past, forever making a different river. You don't want to use slang and colloquial language because in 10 or 20 years, no one perhaps will understand what you're saying. So we do have kind of standard language, and this cartoon illustrates it rather well. So a little boy comes to his dad and says, hey dad, know what I figured out? The meaning of words isn't a fixed thing. Any word can mean anything. By giving words new meanings, ordinary English can become an exclusionary code. Two generations can be divided by the same language. Wow. Notice his vocabulary. He's been doing a lot of dictionary work, hasn't this kid? To that end, by the way, kid is a colloquialism. Note, I should have said, in formal context, child. To that end, I'll be inventing new definitions for common words, so we'll be unable to communicate. Don't you think that's totally spam? It's lubricating. Well, I'm phasing. Marvy, fab, far out. So dad is speaking the slang of the 60s and 70s. All right. One of the reasons I thought it might be helpful to make this available to you is that I have given you the pages in the Little English Handbook here that talk about these very questions. If you want, I'll wait a moment if you want to just copy down the page numbers. If you want to wait, that's fine too. Okay? Let's talk about this and that. That is vague reference. It's treated in the Little English Handbook starting on page 39. What does this or that point to? Be careful. When you're rereading your essay, make sure you haven't done something like this. Mind you, I just said this, you see, but I'm pointing to what's on the screen. When I'm speaking, I can say, don't do this, or could you pick up that? When I'm writing, I have no such arrows. I have no such possibilities. I have to make sure that my pronoun reference is perfectly clear. Now, a pronoun and this and that, in this particular instance, are both demonstrative pronouns. And so they have to have an antecedent, that is, a noun that they refer back to. Which noun does that statement, that first one, that is undeniable, point back to? Poet? Milton? We do this all the time. But we need to learn to avoid it, not because 80% of the time our reader isn't going to understand what we're saying. If I say Milton is an epic poet, that is undeniable. You know what I mean, don't you? Understood is statement. But there are occasions when not spelling it out will mislead your reader. So it's a good habit to develop. Every time you see a this or that, you say to yourself, all right, let's tell my reader exactly what this or that refers to. If it's not self-evident, if there's not a specific noun that it refers to. Dante sees Virgil and Statius meet. I know you haven't done the Divine Comedy yet, most of you, probably all of you, but that's all right. This shows that he was not the only one to be influenced by him. Oh, you see this all the time. What does this refer to? It can't refer to Dante, it can't refer to Virgil, it can't refer to Statius. Meet is a verb. Huh? It's one of those arrows pointing in an unknown direction. Dante sees Virgil and Statius meet. Their encounter reminds them that Virgil influenced others besides himself. That's what you're talking about. You're talking about their meeting, you see, which shows us something. The best thing to do if you can't exactly, without being awkward, place a noun after this, and if it doesn't seem to refer to anything before it, best thing is just to rewrite the whole sentence and make it clear. Oh my God, it is so tricky. And here I'm referring to it in quotation marks, that is to say, the word itself. That's what you do when you talk about a word as word, you put it in quotation marks. Avoid using it without a definite antecedent. It was hopeless for Dante. What was hopeless for Dante? Life? His situation? Better to say Dante was without hope. Avoid placing it near another it with a different meaning, especially. It's bad enough to repeat things. Remember that repetition implies emphasis. Now, better to repeat than to try to get fancy and use all kinds of synonyms just for the sake of not repeating. But be careful. You want to use pronouns so long as you're clear about what the pronoun refers to in the preceding sentence. It would have been better for Satan to have accepted, this is Paradise Lost, of course. It would have been better for Satan to have accepted the Son, that is, God the Son, but it was too much for his pride. Not terribly elegant. But also, in other contexts, it could be a source of confusion. So rewrite the sentence, folks. Imagine your poor reader scratching his or her head over this. Accepting the Son would have been better for Satan. But to do so can only refer back to a verb, can't it? So it has to be accepting, which actually here is a gerund, but we'll get to that later. To do so was too much for his pride. You see how that works? We'll come back to these things in a minute. I'm going to rush through all this, and then we'll have time for questions. Parallel construction. You can find some tips about that on page 42 of the little handbook. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, the things that are supposed to be parallel aren't actually parallel.
Yeah, there's one thing that's out of whack. So let's look at this. You and I are tempted to do this all the time because we want to get it done and we're lazy and we don't think about our poor reader who's got to straighten all this out for him or herself. So look here. Each sin is not so much what she eats as it is disobeying God. Okay. We understand that. But it would be a lot clearer if what you're comparing there, you're comparing a verb, right, and a noun. What she eats is being compared with disobeying. So it'd be better to make them parallel. When you are comparing two things, contrasting two things, keep them grammatically parallel. Make sure this part of speech matches that part of speech. It's that simple. When you're rereading your essay on your screen or on your page, then If you run across comparisons, then just remind yourself, check, and make sure that they are parallel in that sense. Eve's sin is not so much eating an apple as it is disobeying God's command. See, was that so hard? Dante shows us that loving God is to know Him. Here you see, at first we might misread it. We might think that loving God is an adjective. The loving God, you see. So what we want to do is say, Dante shows us that to love God is to know Him. Now we're clear that loving is not an adjective, but an infinitive, actually. Here's a good one. The UD core is intended to develop skills in analyzing major texts, good writing practices, thoughtful reflections on human actions, and a sensitivity to moral matters. There's one slat out of parallel, isn't there? It's better to make them all gerunds, that is, ing words. The UD core is intended to develop skills in analyzing major texts, writing clearly and correctly, reflecting thoughtfully on human actions, and being sensitive to moral matters. Those are the things being compared or listed as elements in a group. Keep them parallel. Okay? And when you're using correlative conjunctions, both and, either or, neither nor, so on and so forth, on the one hand, on the other hand, that kind of thing, you especially want them to be parallel. My favorite, the dangling modifier. Now, an opening phrase that has a form of a verb in it, but is not a complete statement that you could put a period after, so you can't put a period after looking out of the window. That is an introductory phrase. If there is a verb in it, and it's going to be usually a participle, usually a present participle, but maybe a past participle, such as looking out of the window, that must refer to the subject of the following clause. Looking out of the window, I saw the tornado coming. Now, what if I changed this sentence and said, I saw, looking out of the window, the tornado was coming. What's looking out of the window? The tornado. Good trick. You sometimes think tornadoes do have eyes, but in this case, I doubt it. Notice what happens if you put that phrase after, at the end of the sentence, and it's not introductory. Now it refers back to the nearest noun, you see? I saw the tornado looking out of the window. Now it's the tornado looking out of the window. Looking out of the window, I saw the tornado. Looking out of the window, I saw the girl. I saw the girl looking out of the window. Aha! In this case, you see, in the first version of it, I saw the girl. In the second one, it's the girl looking out the window. Or even better, coming around the bend, I saw the train. I saw the train coming around the bend. What if I said, coming around the bend, I saw the train? Who's coming around the bend? I was. I saw the train coming around the bend. Now it's the train. What if you said, coming around the bend, a train was there? I saw the child standing in the middle of the road. Standing in the middle of the road, I saw the child. You get it? All right. So if you open with a participial phrase, one involving an ing word, you could say, gone with the wind, the generations of the past are no more. But you could say, Gone with the Wind. Anyway, you get the point. You could do it with the past participle as well as the present participle, you see. But if it opens the sentence, it's got to refer to the subject of the following clause. Look at the English, little English handbook, starting on page 48. All right. A gerund, a word ending in ing, informed from a verb, that it functions as a noun. You can look up this definition and a comment on it on page 249 of the little handbook. So what's she doing? She's taking a picture of her dog, Gerund, and herself. That's his name, Gerund. Identify the object of amused by. I was amused by her photographing Gerund and his owner using a selfie stick. What's the object of amused by? What word is the object of amused by?
Would it have to become her photographing as a participle?
Well, it's participle, but it's a gerund. That is, a participle used as a noun. See that? I don't like going to town. What do I not like? Town? No, I don't like going. You know why? Because there's construction on 35E all over the place and you sit there in your car getting more and more furious. No, I don't like going to town. It's the going that's tough, you see. When I get to town, it's all right. I don't. Now, here's the problem. You see this all the time, but it can lead to errors. I didn't like her dog barking all night. What did I not like? In that sense. Let me give you a hint. Put a comma after barking. After dog, sorry. Comma after barking. Dog. Now what is it? Dog. I didn't like her dog's barking all night. Now what it is it? Barking. You see that? You need a possessive before these gerunds. The gerund is being used as a noun. Otherwise, there's a difference between not liking the dog's barking all night and detesting the dog himself. If you detest the dog himself, then it doesn't matter whether he's barking or not. You hate the mutt, you see? Now, I'm going to give you some instances of how this sort of thing ends up. I consider him singing in church to be inappropriate. What do I consider to be inappropriate? His singing or him? I'm tempted to make a pun out of him, but you see, I could put a Y and an N in that word, and I would say, I consider him singing in church to be inappropriate, but I don't think that's what it is here. Now look at this one. Confessing your sins in a folk ballad was an interesting idea, Larry, but I'm afraid your singing has forced me to add one more sin to your list. What's inappropriate? Is he inappropriate? I suppose he's not terribly dressed up, but nevertheless, he doesn't look freakish like the first one. Who would scare you out of church if he walked in. So it's his singing, you see. In the previous one, it was him, I thought, inappropriate singing in church. He might have had a lovely voice, but he looks like something out of hell. don't think we want him in church with us. Do you see that? Oh, OMG, the comma. There are a good 19 pages in the Little English Handbook, the comma, 20 pages, actually. The problem with the comma is that it has too many roles to play when you're writing. I call it the comma scythe. Commas separate. They don't join. They separate. But they separate in all kinds of different ways. It's a versatile but dangerous tool that can sever things that belong to together. It can be death to clarity. Watch out. Look at this example. He contacted me as the stocks were going up. That means he contacted me just at the moment when the stocks were rising. Hey, get out there and buy quickly. They're going up. You can make a lot of money here. Look what happens when you put a comma there. He contacted me as the stocks were going up. That's different. In the first instance, you're talking about something that occurs at the same time as the action. In the second one, and unfortunately, we tend to do this more and more, we use as a synonym for because. We also use since, S-I-N-C-E, that is, as a synonym for because. I like to discourage people from saying, as I'm going to town, I can't be with you right now as I have to go to class. You see, we do that a lot colloquially, and you see it in print all the time, but it's I think we should use as for itself and use because in most cases. All right, but that comma then distinguishes a cause. The reason he contacted me is that the stocks were going up. In the first one, he contacted me at the very moment the stocks were going up. I want that stockbroker down there. I want the first one there. He gets to you right away. The other one, we don't know when he got to me. You know, he says, I'm going to get in touch with you. I don't know if you've noticed, but the stocks were going up. All right, restrictive and non-restrictive phrases. Do you know what this means? A restrictive means essential to the meaning of the word. Non-restrictive means extra information, not essential. This is a place where you have opportunities for disconnects. So non-essential clauses or phrases give supplementary information. They should be comma-sized. You know, they should be sort of half cut out. Achilles' friend, Patroclus, was killed by Hector. What's wrong with that? What does that sentence say?
It says that Achilles has only one friend.
That's right. He has only one friend. The second one, Achilles' friend, Patroclus, was killed by Hector. See the difference? It has a meaningful impact on the way you use it, the comma scythe. Odysseus' son Telemachus did not recognize his father. How many sons has Odysseus? Actually, he had one by Circe. Did you know that? There's a story, it's not in the Odyssey, of course, but there's a story about a son he had by Circe. But normally, I think we would say he has only one son, doesn't he? So, we need commas. Why? Because that's additional information. How do you know whether or not you need commas or you need to take out the commas? If there are commas, take out the word and see if it still means the same thing. Odysseus' son did not recognize his father. Does that mean essentially the same thing as Odysseus' son Telemachus did not recognize his father? Yes. Dante the poet is not necessarily identical with Dante the pilgrim. Look what happens if you put commas in here. Take out the commas. What do you get? Dante is not necessarily identical with Dante. Boy, is that a metamorphosizing writer. All right, so you can find information. Oops, sorry about that. Ah, got to get back to it. Oh, everywhere. Oh, no, 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 no. Don't do this to me. Don't. We don't have time. Oh, no, we're stuck. We're stuck in a time warp. All right, come on up here. Okay. All right. The comma splice. You know what a comma splice is, don't you, everybody? This is the other side of the comma scythe. The comma separates things, but sometimes it doesn't separate them enough. It needs an extra point, like a semicolon. Give it a little dot, you know, a little punch. Or help it out with a conjunction or so. Oh, all right, go back. On some days, you know, these things decide that they're in control. Good luck. All right, now. Aeneas is a man typically characterized by thoughtfulness towards both gods and men. Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. It's not strong enough. What's the difference between using a semicolon to separate two independent clauses? An independent clause is one that you can put a period after and it still feels like a whole sentence. So each of these, both gods and men, could have a period after it. Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. Why would you want to put a semicolon between them, like the second sentence? Notice I've got a bunch of conjunctions here. Aeneas is man typically characterized by thoughtfulness towards both gods and men, while Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. Or, and Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. Or, but Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. Or, though Turnus is more prone to sudden acts of rage. In each of those, what you're doing is you're describing the relationship between these two independent statements. The semicolon says, I'm just juxtaposing these. Gives a little bit more emphasis to the fact that you're juxtaposing them, and so on and so forth. But emphasizes the opposition between them. Do you see that? Moving right along. What happened to that? This is a tricky one. You can look at this up in the Middle English Handbook on page 50. When can you leave that out? Not that, the demonstrative pronoun, but that, the conjunction. Dante will discover the circle of hell where Satan is trapped in ice is at the center of our earth. Got it? Dante will discover that the circle of hell where Satan is trapped in ice is at the center of the earth. When there is an object, when there is a noun clause that is an object of the verb that comes just before that, you need that. You need that. He believes Satan, who seems very friendly, is wholly trustworthy. See, there you're inclined to stop at the phrase, Eve believes Satan. Well, she does, but that's not the point of the sentence. If I had said, Eve considers Satan, who seems very friendly, to be wholly trustworthy, you wouldn't need that, would you? Eve believes that Satan. What she believes is not Satan, but the proposition that Satan is wholly trustworthy. There is a difference. Keep in mind, the Rome program has many opportunities to offer. You might start out by reading that as, keep in mind the Rome program. No, that's not what you're trying to say. You're trying to say, keep in mind many opportunities that the Rome program has to offer. Keep in mind that the Rome program has many opportunities to offer. Campus safety reported as soon as they found out that electricity was out, they contacted facilities. What happened? I'm not talking about the electricity. Campus safety reported that as soon as they found out that the electricity was out. You see, you need that there. You'll get totally confused. Students need to make sure not only that they read their assignments ahead of time, but the text they're using is the proper edition. Need to make sure not only, you need a that after not only, just to help us keep track of where we are in that sentence. Now these are quick examples. We could conceivably print them out, but I'm going to end by saying something about organization. This is very, very simple. When you're reading over your paper, after you've written it, look at all of the various stages of evidence that you offer for your final proof. Remember, the path of conviction for your reader, if you want to persuade your reader that you've made your point, strong is what happens when you run out of weak. How so? Weakness is a choice. It's your choice. You want to be clearly understood, but you also want to be persuasive. Put the weakest evidence first. Then put the next, the stronger evidence, and arrange it so that you get stronger as you go along until the strongest bit of evidence comes last. Why? Because if you don't do it that way, it'll either look rather random. Well, here's a bunch of stuff I'm going to throw in here to persuade you that I'm right. Or if you start with the strongest part of your argument, the strongest evidence, it'll look as though you're losing ground as you're going along. You find the kind of pitifully offer this little weak proof at the end, and your reader says, I don't buy it. Right? And that's it. If you do that, if you watch out for some of these things, you'll at least be a lot clearer for your reader. Questions? You want to review any of the slides? I might be able to make that work. I wonder if this thing goes backwards. Does this go backwards? Oh, no, that's right. I took it out. Anything you have questions about? Anything that you want to add? Have I befuddled you totally? Have I not been clear? I've been fast, you know.
Can you say a few words about ending the semester well, or is there anything you want to have revisions to do, or
yes. Get out all your previous papers before you write your last one. Look at all the mistakes you made. Read them all over again. Make a list of your mistakes. As you're writing your last paper, look at the list and say, did I make any of these mistakes here? Think of how you learn, how you train yourself to do things, to play a musical instrument, to be good at basketball. You have to figure out what you're doing wrong in order to do it right. Now bear in mind that language is a conventional structure. None of us, I didn't make up these rules, none of us made up the rules that we're talking about. In fact, a rule is just an agreed upon way of making sure that we're all on the same page. That's what it is. This is not science. Certainly not rocket science. But you do want to get somewhere in your rocket. So here's the problem, you see. If you're a mathematician, and I love mathematics, you're dealing with no ambiguity whatsoever. Two, the numeral two means only one thing. The English word two means three different, the sound two means three different things. There aren't rules that have the kind of logical inevitability about them that you get in mathematics, in language. Language is a bit messy. It has been concocted by many different people. We are all, you might say, creators of the language we use. But we come together when we use language. And we can only come together because we've all agreed that this sound means this concept. That's what it takes. In order to do well in communicating with others, then we simply have to join what I would call the great conversation. We have to agree to use words the way everybody else uses them. The more precise we get, and that's what we're trying to learn how to do, we're trying to learn how to write more precisely to get my meaning exactly across so that you can't mess around with it and say, I said something different, by God. That's the key to it all. By the way, do you know where I took this picture? It's not very far from where I live. Can you guess what this company does? Clearly understood. That's the name of the company. That's their office. It's a legal firm. That helps you sort out legalese. And you know, that's true of legal language. Every one of those unfamiliar words has a specific meaning. And you have to say, okay, I don't want to get sued. I better find out exactly what this is. My job is to make sure that you develop the skills to be clearly understood. That's all our job. It's your job too, but we're trying to help you. And by the way, somebody is paying us to do this. If it's not you, it's your parents. If it's not your parents, it's some benefactor that gave you a scholarship. So we are your slaves. Remember that. But in the ancient Greco-Roman world, slaves were teachers very often. They gave their life for the sake of clarity. I'm kidding.